This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico Listener Supported Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the Foothills, and beyond. You are listening to Love in the 21st Century on every Tuesday from 5 to 6, hosted tonight by myself, Tamara, and Adam Mose. Love in the 21st Century is a talk show with live call-ins, interviews, and discussions on the philosophical to the practical look of love, from romantic relationships to connections with humanity, one-third dating insights, one-third self-love guide, one-third compassion training, and we will be continuing on with our conversation about love and community from a new perspective. Adam, would you like to give our listeners a sneak peek of what will be the topic of conversation?
It's all of us and how well we're treating one another and how we want to go about improving that. You know, I'm still... a work in progress, so, you know, a part of the community, and want to encourage us all to just realize that we're all making this happen all the time. It's our minds, and the world that we're making is the future that we're taking. So let's...
I like it. That rhymed. And as some of you know that listen to this show on a regular basis, we started with self-love and we moved to family love and we then moved to intimate relational love, and now we're talking about community and love. So we're kind of taking just a jaunt in many different directions of where this love is and how it grows and different perspectives. So please call in and share your own personal perspective of what you're taking from what we're sharing. And also, if you just have something different to add to the conversation, we invite you to give us a call. This is a call-in radio show. The phone number is 895-1114. That will get you on the line. If the line is busy, be patient. We will answer the phones. And again, that number is 895-1114. And we'll be right back after a nice song.
We will find a friend.
All right. Welcome back, listeners, to Love in the 21st Century. And as we began the show, we were starting to talk about the topic tonight, which is love and community. And this, I believe, is our fifth week talking about love and community, but always from a new perspective. And Adam is bringing that perspective to us tonight. So thank you, Adam, for being here.
And I guess my confession, you know, my bias is I'm a Buddhist practitioner, and I've been working with the meditation and studying the Buddhist philosophy. So one of the things, you know, we take refuge in when they say, oh, what's Buddhism? It's always Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Sangha is community, and originally meant like the people who are meditating and practicing together. But the Mahasangha is your community, everyone who has the Buddha nature, who has the capacity to enlighten inherent within them, doesn't have to be added, doesn't have to be bought or, you know, even cultivated. It's already there, perfect within each individual. So in that sense, you know, our degree that we're able to, you know, embrace and rejoice, celebrate the differences in our uniqueness, and then also, you know, have this recognition of a large family, like the feeling of it being brothers and sisters, fathers and mothers. When the Native Americans say all my relations, you know, they mean not just all the humans being related, but all of life, you know, that we're a part of. And the natural response is loving kindness, gentleness, and like how vulnerable and how slow to develop we are compared to all the other animals. The humans, like from our very biological basis, no inherent weapons, no nails or teeth of any, you know, means, then we learn, you know, that it's relationship and it's the compassion and this being part of a larger collective that allows us to feel safe and to feel the momentum of all of the different generations, you know, like how. And I think back on my parents and my parents' parents and the situations that they had to endure and their vision for a more freer, a more equitable future for their kids. That's what they lived for, you know, and I reap the benefits. I don't recognize that. I don't thank them enough. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like my father's father was a traveling salesman, something, Chicago and New York, and died really young, you know, with my father still being in his early 20s. And then, you know, my dad was like, I'm not going to do that same mistake. I'm going to have to find a different way. So, he got as far as he could in terms of his own enlightenment and his development, and then, you know, made his mistakes and made, you know, his limitations kicked in. And then, but the advantages and the kind of like the awakening that we have, you know, like the, for instance, my high school, I was into drama, and there's this drama class. And now my daughter gets to go to Inspire. Mm-hmm. And they have a whole school focused on performing arts and the sciences and these things that, you know, it's like the high school I would have loved to have gone to.
Absolutely.
But that's the whole point. That's the whole reason why we're able. And I never designed that. I never, you know, like, oh, this is how we're going to make that happen. But as a collective, we seem to be reaching for something, more freedoms, more of the fullness of each individual coming out, you know, being able to express and experience itself in its greater and greater perfection.
Mm-hmm.
That is happens in the environment of love. If we have that as a goal and as a path and as the container, then lifetime after lifetime, we can hold one another. We can evolve together. So that's my very hopeful vision.
it's a beautiful vision.
And the perspective I'm coming from. And then the other thing is like how, even if you say you don't have any perspective, or, you know, my perspective is this particular ideology or that ideology, the way that we operate our minds,
mm-hmm.
thought by thought, is what we experience. So the world, like our small corner of the world here in beautiful Chico, is the sum total of all the minds, thought by thought, that make it up. So that's my big advocacy for meditation,
mm-hmm.
that you get to look at your mind thought by thought, experience it, and cultivate it. So it's not like I think, therefore I am. It's like I'm thinking. And then what am I going to do about it now? How can I improve on that? And then have my experience of the world. Well, it's okay, there's these bias, you know. Magical thinking has been tested. When I meditate in the morning, I seem to have more time, more patience for my interactions during the day than when I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's a tremendously subjective, you know, measure. There's no way to measure. I mean, you probably could. How much patience this person has, you know, and then teach them to meditate, and they meditate that day. Do they have more patience? Some way to, you'd have to like trick them into getting provoked,
mm-hmm.
and see how fast they're like, ugh, oh yeah, I'm pissed. But so it's a subjective
mm-hmm.
experience. But it's been proven. I mean, I prove it to myself. I'm like, okay, is that really true? Okay, I'm not going to meditate today. And then things don't go as smoothly.
Right. So you're doing the social experiment for us all.
I'm doing it on myself, yeah. Right.
It's interesting. So you're saying that the perspective that we approach the world with, thought by thought, is thus creating the world that we interact with. And so each of us taking the mindfulness approach to the world that we're creating will overall help us collectively create a stronger community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
I got more space. I got more natural love to hold you all in.
Right. It's interesting too what you were mentioning before about our culture now, how it has developed to have and make space for more specialized or sub-communities to exist in their full authenticity, so that
mm-hmm.
youth can grow and develop in their what they're naturally drawn to, instead of it being either completely removed from the school system or having to sort of put up with the adversity of social norms if that's not what they're drawn to. And I guess what I'd like to add to that overall vision is the eventual blending of those subcultures, where it's not necessarily, you know, that you have to identify with any one particular one of those communities. I feel like that's still a strong reality.
Right. And so now I'm going to go into a little bit of the definitions. You know, Buddhists, we love definitions and lists.
Awesome.
We want to get it logical.
Yes.
And if you miss it all, you know, we started with the basic definition of love.
Mm-hmm.
Really, you know, the working definition is wanting the other's happiness.
Right.
Being willing to work for and aid in the other's happiness, you know, even like before one's own. And then, well, you know, people go, oh, but what about me? That's okay. You're one of those, you know, who deserves the happiness as well. Then the other idea of the six in one, we were talking about like identity and the sense of self and one's, you know, relational understanding of oneself. Like we get who we are through our relationships.
Absolutely.
And then there's these six big formative relationships that make a like almost like a initial indelible stamp. And they're large scale. It's the my mother, myself, my father, myself, my family, myself, or the lack thereof. You know, mm-hmm. if folks missing those crucial relationships, then that leaves an indelible mark as well. The fourth is the my peer group, myself. And that first little peer group when we're like 12, 13, 14, and we're going to fit in, feeling like we're accepted, you know, there's like a crowd, you know, we're part of, or just those close friends that we first feel like click.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beginning of community, our sense of community.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes further. We say, like, we were talking the culture, my culture, myself, and there's subcultures, and then the my society, myself relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so all together, society, culture, and peer group makes up our community.
Mm-hmm.
It's a spectrum of all of those inputs, the karmic connection that we have with those relationships.
Mm-hmm. And do you start with the peer group because that's when we begin to identify ourselves outside of our family unit or
exactly.
our family community? Because I mean, in a sense, there is the family community that you're often a part of.
Totally. All the six interpenetrate.
Mm-hmm.
And like in psychology, they talk about family cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And this amazing work that was done in the 80s with adult children of alcoholics. And they discovered like there was certain predictable kind of patterns. If there was substance abuse in a family, that the kids would compensate or react, and it would go in this certain constellation. There's varieties, differences of that, but it would be like pretty predictable.
Mm-hmm.
And this was discovered like in family counseling, which is such a beautiful process, such a beautiful thing. You know, you work with a counselor on a one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
You can get so far, but especially if it's a child, it's you work with them in the context of their family, and then you see the whole dynamics and the constellation that's brought about. You know, like there's one designated problem
mm-hmm.
individual of the family, but it's because the whole family's got this constellation
right.
that that problem shows up that way. So the we're saying subcultures even within the family
mm-hmm.
but then when we're finding our identity apart from the family of origin, the first point of contact is our peer group and what they're into, you know, and fitting in. And fantastic. They're into what you're into, but if they're into, you know, some bad stuff, they want to push the envelope and you know, make bad choices. A relatively, you know, I'm kind of pliable. I kind of go along with what's going on. You can go into that and end up making bad choices. You know, not oh, it's what the crew is doing.
Right.
So. Then you learn about that from the larger culture and hopefully initially from the family.
Mm-hmm.
Like if there was a good the context for identity within the family is strong enough, then you're like, oh, okay, even if all my friends are doing this, I don't need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, suffer the consequences of that. You know, I'm not going to be in with that in group.
Right.
Even if they're doing crummy things, I don't have to. And right. And the trust that I have enough love, I have enough support, that bit by bit, my community, the folks who are going to be feeding me, are going to come along.
A beautifully optimistically challenging experience, I think, for some youth, but very much so if they have that strong source of community and identity, like you were saying, with the family, then they will pursue in the path that will be most advantageous for them.
Mm-hmm.
And possibly not if they don't have that strong sense of identity.
Yeah.
Or also possibly, I've also have friends that have had adverse family conditions and because of that had a strong identity within themselves in determination to not continue in that, you know, family history pattern. So there's a lot to be said for, you know, personal choice and personal willpower and determination and your chosen way of life.
So there is free will.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Intend it and envision it and step by step, make it so.
Make it so. Be aware of one's free will. Because if we are often socially constructing our reality based on what is told to us or explained to us or shown to us through our media, then we are surrendering that free will rather than being consciously aware that we can choose to make a different choice.
Wow, wow.
Yeah.
That took me a long ways to come around. And it is like in the mind. I did this meditation retreat in the Himalayas in my 20s. And, you know, I received these beautiful instructions from my refuge master. I took refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha. Then it's official. I'm a Buddhist. And I'm going to go up walking into the Himalayas and sit in this cave. And it's going to be wonderful. And I got up there and just TV jingles from the 70s and 80s, all these jingles. And, you know, the intros, those little catchy tunes they have in the intros. If you're going to watch the show, you got to see the intro and get that tune going there. They just went blah, 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 barf, 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 out of my mind. Couldn't stop it. And I realized, you know, I grew up on a lot of boob tube. And that's changed. That's changed in some ways. My daughters are growing up on YouTube. And they pick what they want to watch. You know, there's a certain interest in a certain area that they want to, or, you know, they want to veg out on. This is something entertaining for them. They're just going to relax and go into this. But it's always like on their push button.
Very different.
It's so different. And I can't help but think it's a little bit evolved. You know, if the show was on, you had to watch it.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's different. They share some similarities in terms of the external influence coming in without maybe a filter of determination of whether this is like worthy worthy information to be being stored in your brain, but in the sense that it is a personal choice about what you're watching and the removal of the kind of stature of the people that you're seeing on YouTube, because a lot of it is just people
peer to peer.
So it's something that it's like it's almost more an empowering form of media than your typical television show, which is, you know, the stature of this actress or actor,
right? And it comes through by way of the network. It's just going to be commoditized. You know, you're watching it is what pays for it. The advertisers and are there, and you can't escape it. But somehow, you know, that was seen as culture. Culture also is like all of our artifacts, all of the stuff of our creativity that we share and that builds and represents, you know, who we are as a people. That's like another definition of a culture.
Right.
But to the extent that I've identified with that, you know, there's certain positive things about my culture that I want to continue, I want to embody, and there's other things that I have no use for.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point I say, okay, that didn't serve me about the culture that I was given. Now I'm co-creating with my community, with my peers, our own culture and our own society. That's the real great vision. And I had this this interesting little exchange on my Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I was coming down to the studio, I wanted to share. One of my friends was sharing a poem from Tagore.
Mm-hmm.
And Tagore says, "So I repeat, we never can have a true view of man unless we have a love for him. Civilization must be judged and prized, not by the amount of power it has developed, but by how much it has evolved and given expression to, by its laws and institutions, the love of humanity." And I was like, whoa, there's a lot in there.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, one of my other friends commented on my friends and said, you know, he likes Tagore very much. But he says in that quote, he doesn't believe that laws and institutions can ever express anything to do with love or humanity.
Hmm.
And because he's a you know, rugged individualist, this friend of mine. He's actually an awesome guy.
I believe that he is.
But he's saying, he says, in fact, they're opposed to humanity, the laws and the institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And but then my buddy who shared the quote responded. He said that, oh, there's the Clean Water Act. There's the Clean Air Act, you know.
Right.
And then the abolition of slavery, et cetera,
right.
et cetera.
Absolutely.
That there is ways in which our society has progressed.
Right. It reminds me of learning, there's a book, I can't remember the title, about what the most searched topics on the internet are. And just to give it a general idea, it's not the most talked about concepts in our world, and mostly focuses in sexuality. And it was, you know, a lot of people had a lot of disgust towards it and were very appalled, and there was blogs about this book, and the author responded that our internet is only a reflection of our culture. And mm-hmm. so if it's so bothersome for them in that way, what's going on the internet, then maybe to take a greater look at our
mm-hmm.
culture and mm-hmm. what is creating that reality for
mm-hmm.
our internet. And also, I would say the same thing about our laws and our institutions, is that we mm-hmm. as people create those laws and institutions. So mm-hmm. in a way, they are coming from a place of love, whether they're in the right place at that time, you know, if we agree with them or not. It's that same concept that like the Clean Water Act or the abolition of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is there to help and protect people in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can see it from that perspective, then we're able to sort of shift our perspective of being resistant to it, scared of it, or controlled by it, and see like,
mm-hmm.
oh, right, that law or that internet or that book was actually created by a person just like me.
Mm-hmm.
And so somewhere in my humanity, this truth exists. And so if I can start to see it from that perspective, I can start to help it to shift
mm-hmm.
instead of in this place of being controlled or resistance, which only in reality, in my perspective, gives it more power.
This is the jump into the sixth, the top of the heap, the my society, myself
mm-hmm.
contemplation. And what about society do we value and want to keep? And what is already, you know, rotten and ready to drop away.
Right.
It's intense.
But that's a collective effort that we're all needing to be a part of, because we could, you know, each go out and meditate in a cave by ourselves, but then we're still there by ourselves. And when you come back to society, there's still other people that are going to be struggling with the same things that you were struggling with, or maybe a completely different degree of what you were, you know, working through. Mm-hmm. But at the same point, it's like if one person reaches enlightenment, it's about the collective reaching it. So
yeah.
How do we bring it back?
And well, the collective is a collection of individuals. Mm-hmm. So each individual within that would attain their enlightenment. It's something unique
mm-hmm.
to the individual.
Right. But the like you were saying with the love of the other, it's like helping, like once you've reached that enlightenment, reaching to the other to inspire that within themselves rather than just allowing for a, you know, continued control by a culture that
there's almost two different strands. Again, here we go with more definition.
Mm-hmm.
But enlightenment in the strict Buddhist sense, you know, has a certain meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And then they refer to like the development of the Western thought and the Western freedoms as the enlightenment. It's mm-hmm. that's what it's called in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're also using it in the sense of like a community, a society getting smarter about how it's legislating itself and organizing itself to put up less obstacles for the enlightenment of its individuals that make it up.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like three different meanings
right.
of enlightenment that are related. They have some commonalities, but then also we want to make it distinct that way. Can I play you a little lovey song?
Sure.
This is my favorite piece of music ever.
right, welcome back. Love in the 21st Century. Tamara here with Adam Mose, and Jonah just stepped in the studio as well. Hi, Jonah.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Yeah, so Jonah's going to share with us here in a bit about something he has upcoming, but right now we're going to continue on our conversation about love and community with Adam. And I just want to ask about when I had mentioned to you that the show name was, or show topic was, love and community, and that you responded with calm unity. Uh-huh. And if you wanted to just kind of talk about that for
a little bit. That relates to my focus. My main focus is healing, and I'm working as Chinese medicine. So through that modality, helping people find their healing. So the turns out, just a calm, loving environment where you're feeling felt starts you on this road to healing. You have to think that it's possible, to feel that it's possible. So there's another little quote I was going to share along those lines with Wendell Berry. He's saying, healing is impossible in loneliness. It's the opposite of loneliness. He says, healing is the opposite of loneliness. Conviviality is healing. To be healed, we must come with all the other creatures to the feast of creation. And he has a capital C for creation there, like something significant for him.
Right.
You know?
I like that. I've been diving into Brené Brown's work recently, and she says something similar, that shame is impossible to heal alone.
Yeah.
We have to have other people in community to help us work through our shame.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said to be witnessed through one's healing, and to, I believe, to get to a certain point in that healing alone, I believe it's possible, but to really, have it come home and to expand your heart into a way that it's going to help you grow and expand and trust in others, which is a large extent what community is about, and what a large extent our lives really are about, is that connection to others. And so if that healing, if I feel shameful about something, or if I feel pain from, whether that's self-inflicted or inflicted by another, and I'm over here mending my heart and mending my wounds, I'm going to get to a certain point of like, okay, I'm strong enough to readdress the world. But at the same time, it's almost like building that strength as like armor. Like I'm going to get stronger so that I can be back in the world, but it doesn't mean I'm necessarily going to trust the world.
Be more vulnerable.
Right.
Allow the connection. So that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
Calm unity.
Right.
That we're recognizing that we're making something larger than ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime, every time we come together, and there's this peace, there's the possibility of calmness, then the connection becomes deeper. And this is something I learned in massage school, like over 30 years ago. They're like, to go deeper, you have to go slower. So this kind of speed, the original kind of like way that you got to operate at this certain speed to be in the culture. That's fine, to be fast thinking and all that part. But to feel with another, it means like this kind of like slowing down and opening out in that vulnerable thing. And then what you're saying, like the shame part of it, it's hard to heal for the individual alone, because my understanding, and this is not a Buddhist definition or anything, this is just my idea about it. Shame originally, like how it's in our DNA, happened when you were going to be expelled from the tribe. Like there was something that, somehow you're going to be like, boop, kicked out of this particular group, like to be shamed.
Mm-hmm.
It was like your inclusion with the unity is at stake. You know, that's kind of the feeling. And maybe, you know, you got it from one person. Another person was shaming you. But they use that energy that we have in our DNA.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, oh, someone had to be kicked out of the cave posse. You know, we're talking evolutionary. That was a large part of our human history. That fitting in, being with the tribe, meant life. Meant you're going to be able to survive.
Yeah, it's definitely a biological and cultural process. I've learned that shame is actually one of the few kind of impulsive reactions that we're biologically programmed to do. And it's actually noted that shame is associated with things like muscles in your neck. So like if something happens that shames you, there's actually this like release of tension in your neck and your head drops down.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Which is like the classic
hanging
image of someone in shame.
Uh-huh.
Or shoulders kind of crunch up, or mm-hmm. the just kind of a cowering look is actually a biological response to certain types of cultural stimulus.
And then we flip it. I love to flip the, hit you with the alternative image. Relaxing and opening your chest out and holding your head high and knowing that you're part of the group. You're a loved and cherished member, valued, you
mm-hmm.
know, for just who you are.
That you cannot be actually be separate from
yeah.
what you perceive yourself to be separate from.
Right.
So when you were sharing, Adam, I was thinking about that when you're talking about the evolutionary shaming, so the actual fear of being excluded.
Mm.
But often now what we're talking about is that perceived idea of shaming. So whether or not someone's actually shaming you or you feel
yeah.
shameful for
yeah.
your actions, it still has that same influence on us of,
yeah.
of that deep biological or, you know, ancestral wound of shaming. Like, oh, if people found this out or if I'm judged for this, I would be excluded and disconnected.
Disconnection is the worst.
Right.
Solitary confinement is the worst punishment,
mm-hmm.
they say. But then, you know, our first thing we were saying about the Mahasangha, that the three jewels that makes up the objects of refuge in Buddhism, there's Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and they're equal. It's not like Buddha's better than Sangha. Sangha means community, and Mahasangha means all the beings, everyone. So with that understanding, I've had teachers, I've had, you know, some of my personal, like, really great masters who went through solitary confinement or went through hard labor camps underneath the Chinese occupation of Tibet and emerged, you know, compassionate, forgiving, really balanced individuals. And I'm thinking, like, oh, you know, they must have this connection with this larger vision, this larger group, where even if there's this smaller group that's kicking me out, you know, that's saying, oh, I've, you know, done bad and I have to go do this prison time, even then, I still understand that there's a larger group that's holding me, that's holding these accusers in its embrace, and that, you know, we're not going to be lonely in that larger unfolding vision. So having that on a cellular level, having being able to understand that in one's body means, you know, these guys were the living examples. They had served time. They had done like to 12 years or something. It's
wow.
hard labor, and progressed on their spiritual path as they were doing that.
It's interesting that you say this, that solitary confinement is one of the worst things we could go through. I thought about this before, that you're giving this example of then these like Buddhists who went through that, but they came out actually more compassionate. And I'm thinking back to, I was listening to the show downstairs earlier, and I'm imagining you being in the Himalayas and meditating and having thinking about the tunes and the intros.
Barney Miller.
But there's something similar between solitary confinement and intensive meditation retreat. I've been to a 10-day Vipassana retreat, and it was one of the most intense things that I've ever done. But it seems that there's something about that intensity that, with the right mindset and attention of focus, can put you out in different ways.
Right. It's all about the intention, how we're going into it, and that's a big portion of the path as well. We're saying, like, initially spiritual path, it seems like, oh, people who are been walking the path, they seem to be happy. They have this kind of inner buoyancy, resilience, and I want that. You know, I'm going to aspire to that for myself, mm-hmm. and it's kind of an intelligent selfishness. In that way, Dalai Lama talks about that. You know, it's like, if you're compassionate with others, your life is going to be more happy. You know, you have genuinely better relations with others. If you're generous with them and looking, seeing their best nature, looking to see the good in them, in any possible interchange with anyone, then naturally you're going to have more happiness. So it's like this kind of intelligent selfishness. He wants more happiness, so I'm going to adopt this attitude of compassion and cultivate it, like make it something even more substantial and real and ongoing. And we do that by convincing ourselves. It's kind of like this little logical thing. Like all the beings want happiness for themselves, and they're going about it in sometimes lopsided ways. But like even this guy who's shaming me, kicking me out, you know, he's doing it because he thinks he's going to ultimately make himself happier.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm. So if there's one thing that our listeners could adopt from this show, it would be to harness and cultivate compassion within themselves.
It's so valuable. It's going to be like the future of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Not just doctors rediscovering their own compassion, but the mindset that you get into by feeling compassion. Then you feel yourself part of a larger community. The loneliness portion goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And then the genuine healing can start, you know, from the bodily level.
I heard of a study once where they had people do, where they asked people, like, what's something that you've always dreamed of doing? And it would be something like wild, like skydive, or just something, that some kind of dream, like a bucket list kind of idea.
Mm.
And then they had them do the thing. And then they had them do something that was an act of care for mm-hmm. other people. Like it was more of a giving experience. I don't know, maybe like serving soup in a kitchen or something.
Yeah.
And then they had them rate their happiness levels like the day after doing both of those things.
Boom.
And the happiness levels were rated higher after doing the thing that was for other people
than
doing the thing on their bucket list that they had always dreamed of doing.
Yeah, this was like when my folks really started worrying about me, because they had been raised in this thing of like of selfishness, like the Ayn Rand kind of selfishness. And I'm not so familiar with her philosophy or whatever, but it's really like looking out for number one, that kind of unintelligent selfishness. But we went to LA and we were going to help my grandma and or go to the fun park. We were going to go to Magic Mountain. I hadn't been there for years and years. I'm like, oh, my bucket list. I got to ride all those roller coasters. Or I could clean out grandma's refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And I opted the latter. And they're like, whoa, okay, Adam's really kind of gone off the deep end. It's so bizarre. But it did feel better. And, you know, grandma was able, had a cleaner place after that.
Mm.
Loving, compassionate choices. So we're going to be segueing here soon. Thank you so much, Adam, for sharing the community perspective to love and community. And, yeah, is there any last words you have to share with us before we start talking a bit about what Jonah's got going on this weekend?
I'll just hop on my little soapbox and say once again, we're all family.
Yes.
We're all in this together. We got to look out for one another and bit by bit cultivate that loving kindness and let it show through in all of the actions, all of the speech. If there's some crummy speech that's not going to be helpful, that's not going to be heard, I'll just be quiet. Right. I just won't go there.
Mm-hmm. And then cultivating that compassion, I just want to add that cultivation includes yourself. So having compassion with yourself for wherever you're at in your own process and path, because that's just as important and just as valuable for you to be able to show up in whatever way that you need to show up without having that self-imposed feeling of being excluded.
Aho.
Aho. So thank you so much. Hey, Jonah.
Hey.
So we're going to talk about another thing that community can get involved with this weekend, yeah?
Yes.
So what do you got going on?
So just to remind the audience, I am a counselor, communication coach, and conflict mediator. And this weekend, I am offering a seminar for the second time. Although the first time I did this, it was only for men. But now I'm opening it up to everyone. And it's primarily geared towards couples and singles. And the name of the seminar is How to Make Intimacy Last. Essentially, it's going into the fact that a lot of times in relationships, we find that intimacy is so much easier in the beginning of a relationship. And then as time goes on, it gets harder and harder and harder. And so what I'm doing in this is I'm sharing what I've found and in the learning and studying that I've done that makes a huge, huge change. And can really help with making it last and deepening it. I'm going to be talking about the difference between intimacy and sex and how they affect one another. I'll be sharing three massive mistakes that kill intimacy in both short-term and long-term relationships, and we'll be focusing on the value of self-love and embracing your own desires. So the seminar is going to be at the Sky Creek Dharma Center this Saturday from 2:00 to 4:30, and it's free. So I'm welcoming all individuals and couples or any type of relationship that you would like to deepen intimacy with. Let's see, I think that's it.
Sounds great. So it's this Saturday. And what time does it start?
This Saturday at the Sky Creek Dharma Center, and it starts at 2:00 till 4:30. And if you'd like, it would be, you don't have to, but it would be nice for me if you'd register before coming, so I know you're coming. And you can do that at eventbrite.com and type in how to make intimacy last.
Awesome. How to make intimacy last seems like a worthy couple 2.5 hours to talk
yes,
about.
Yes, it's going to be awesome and you'll love it.
Absolutely. So if you're in a relationship, if you're single, if you're just inquiring because it's good information to be thinking about, then sign up on eventbrite.com or show up at Sky Creek Dharma Center on Saturday at 2:00. Or I'm sure you can find an event page on Facebook.
Yes, so if you go to Facebook and you type in how to make intimacy last, you can find it there. You can also find it on my website, my personal website, which is just my name, jonahrichman.com.
jonahrichman.com, and you can also find out more information about Jonah there.
Yes.
I'm imagining. So if you want to just get a little bit more insight on the man behind the workshop, you can check it out there, jonahrichman.com.
Oh, I have a website too.
Oh yeah? So if you want to find out more about Adam, what's your website, Adam?
It's about Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha.
Nice.
So it's just bds.care. C-A-R-E, like I care for you.
bds.care?
Yeah, and it's the loose kind of vloggity thing about whatever's catching my fancy. So
awesome.
It's just fun.
But usually in those kind of three veins, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha?
Exactly.
Awesome.
You also have a website for another website, right? For your acupuncture business?
AcuAdam.com.
Yeah, that's the one.
Is for the, if you want to get healed up with the acupuncture and herbs.
Great. You can find out more about both these gentlemen on the webs if you are curious. So thank you so much for tuning in. We have a song for you as we're going out. We'll be with you next Tuesday. Enjoy your evening and cultivate that compassion. 'Cause I